This is Trepwire Week in Review for week ending March 24th, 2023. I'm Martha Kocher with Trep, a data modeling and analytics firm for the CMBS, commercial real estate, and CLM markets. I'm with Manus Clancy, Senior Managing Director, and Lonnie Hendry, Head of CRE and Advisory Services. This week, the Fed raised interest rates by 25 basis points amid concerns over bank liquidity. And while comments by the Fed chair indicated the commitment to fighting inflation, the rhetoric was slightly different. Meanwhile, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, in testimony to lawmakers, seemed to squash the idea of a blanket depositor insurance program. And investors definitely noticed. Meanwhile, the bank fallout is still playing out with Silicon Valley, Signature, and Credit Suisse. Manus.
It was a really head-spinning week, wasn't it? It's really been a head-spinning 2 weeks between Silicon Valley, Signature, and Credit Suisse. As listeners know from the last 2 years, I tend to be a glass half full guy. I think that these disruptions don't last forever, whether they're supply chain, higher interest rates, unemployment, you know, retail downturns, and so forth. We come out of these, even when we were at our bleakest moments in 2008 and 2009, when there were layoffs across the board, across many industries in the US, the banking system was creaky. If not failing, bailouts were plentiful, and CMBS and CRE delinquency shot through the moon. Even during that time, I felt like this was a resetting of things. I do think that that's where we are now. We are resetting things, but I think the market has yet to really digest how painful this is going to be, not just for CRE and CMBS, but for the broader market. I think that until March 10th or March 9th, whenever Silicon Valley had that $42 billion withdrawal day, I think that the CRE market and the US economy was already starting to face extremely strong headwinds. The rising rates were really starting to bite. The interest rate caps were problematic. Sources of capital were drying up. And that was before we saw this run on banks. Why am I so bearish or subdued today? Well, there's three or four reasons. Reason number one is I think that this depositor withdrawal issue hasn't even shown us the tip of the iceberg at this point. If you are a CFO with more than $250,000 in liquid assets, you are spending morning, noon, and night trying to distribute this around to various banks. Right? You are taking it out of community banks in some cases. You are taking it out of regional banks in some cases. And what that does is heighten the risk that there will be more problems down the road, more bank runs. That's without a doubt. It increases the likelihood that we will see more bank failures. The glass half full is that we are limited to only a tightening of credit, right? The upside of this is the worst case scenario or the best case scenario is banks just stop lending, but they don't go out of business. And so that's a really, really scary place to be. Reason number two is, and this is a little bit of inside baseball, but with the CS buyout, the AT1 bondholders took losses instead of equity holders. AT1 bonds, for those that don't know, and this was something new to me over the last week. So if you don't know, don't feel like you've missed anything. I had to look it up myself. These were bonds that were issued to help banks improve their tier one capital. And the thought was that these would always be senior to shareholder equity. I think there was a report on CNBC today that said in the documents it was disclosed that that's not true, but nobody believed that. So when these losses were taken by the AT1 bondholders, what it did was blow out credit risk premiums. Spreads on AT1 bonds doubled overnight from handles of 7 or 8% yields to handles of 15%. What that did was it pulled the entire risk yield curve higher and wider and more painful. So if it was hard for CMBS issuers to price risk, to warehouse bonds, to issue CMBS loans or write CMBS loans 2 weeks ago, it is damn near impossible right now for them to do so. So when you add these two things together, banks getting crimped on the ability to lend, squirreling away their capital. CMBS not able to write loans right now. And who knows where the non-bank sector is right now, right? They require warehouse lending from banks. I mean, I'm assuming that they're getting choked off as well. And what this means is the ability to get capital or the availability of capital has just run into a cement wall. And what that means is, I think Lonnie brought this up last week, no construction lending, hard to get refinancing lending, extend and pretend, and you don't know where this takes us. And it makes me very concerned.
Yeah, I think all of those are valid concerns, Manus. I think if you look at each of them independently, any of those singular things could take the market down. You look at them in culmination together, it's really, really daunting. I think even in your analysis of maybe this is just a credit crunch and banks stop lending as a silver lining, that assumes that the underlying collateral that they already have existing loans on continue to perform and that they're able to cover debt service and that they're able to continue to meet the covenants of their existing loans. And the reality is for a lot of these property sectors and certain markets, they're not going to be able to do that. So you add that on top of it, you're going to have a credit crunch, properties that are not performing. And then we've talked for the last couple of months around maturities and all this other stuff, that those things are going to happen, whether the market's good, bad, interest rates are high or low, loans are going to come to maturity. And it's going to be compounded in real time. I think the pace at which we've seen these things happen in the marketplace is, that's the scary part for me. We've been talking about office distress. We've been talking about hotel distress during COVID. We've talked about some of these things, but to see it actually play out basically over the course of a weekend and the hammer just get dropped. And then now you start looking at all these other institutions that maybe still have potential downside of insolvency. It gets really scary really quickly. So I think, in the lead in, Martha talked about the 25 basis point rate hike. I don't think most people were shocked or surprised by that. I think, Powell's made it clear that he's going to stay the course. I think the markets have basically priced in that he's not, even after yesterday's announcement. But if you listen to what he's saying, he's saying there's not going to be any rate decreases this year. In fact, I think he said yesterday, the market is getting it wrong if it expects rate cuts later this year. It's not in our baseline expectation. And they actually have, one more hike kind of baked in for this year. So he's towing the line. The markets are, basically saying they don't think that he'll do that. I think Barry Sternlicht, when you're in Vegas sometimes and you're a musician or a comedian, you get a residency, at a premier hotel. I think Barry has a residency now at CNBC because it seems like every time you turn the TV on, he's on there. And he's, basically saying that we're accelerating this crisis. I think he used the term today of driving a car 80 miles an hour into a solid wall. And so it'll be very interesting. I don't think Janet Yellen did anyone any favors yesterday, because after the 25 basis point hike, she comes in and says they haven't really considered any type of blanket insurance to banking deposits. And there was talk over the weekend of them maybe trying to find a way without congressional approval to, insure depositors. And she said that is not on the table. I think she's backtracked pretty heavily today and said they're going to look at all options. But mixed signals. I think if you're a layperson looking at this stuff, you probably listen to all of these people talk that you're supposed to have faith in, that they have a plan of action. And I think they show themselves to be as confused as somebody that doesn't know anything about the financial markets, unfortunately.
It was a very, very rough week for Janet Yellen. The congressional testimony, when she was asked by Senator Lankford, I believe, of Oklahoma, about the status of community banks, it really sounded like they're on their own. And then yesterday, to pull the rug out from under Powell, only added to that. And it underscores what I said in the beginning, which is maybe after a week, if you're a CFO at a firm, you're starting to say, well, I have some time now, right? The panic is over. I don't have to move my money tomorrow. Every time Janet Yellen spoke this week, these guys were back to, we have to distribute this money everywhere. And that's a really terrifying thing. And I'm going to pivot right now to something that I was going to save for the end of the podcast, but I'm going to say it now, that it kind of is of a line that the kind of things that I was saying at the beginning of COVID, when we were at our darkest moments in COVID. I was urging people, if they could, if they had the means, to keep their cleaning people on, put some money in their pocket. If you go get a haircut, pay for two, right? The people that were most at the bottom of the economic cycle that we didn't know if there was going to be a bailout or what, to keep them going, tip heavily, tip the people that were delivering your food or anything else. Now, if there's a plea I could make right now is for the people that are withdrawing things to get to that $250,000 limit, use other community banks, use other smaller banks, use regional banks. You know what I watched today? That scene out of A Wonderful Life where Mrs. Davis says, I'll take $17.50 instead of $20 during the run on the bank. It's a very emotional scene. I love that movie and I love that scene. Be Mrs. Davis in this moment. Be that person who says, yes, I want to take my $4 million and distribute it, but it doesn't have to go to Citibank or JP Morgan. It could go to other regional banks that help keep your local economy solvent, right? You want four or five bidders in your community, liquid, making capital available. If this starts taking out 100, 200, 300, 500 community banks, this is bad for everybody. It's bad for the local community. It's bad for unemployment. It's bad for the banking system. It's bad for borrowers. So, you know, that's the end of my moralizing, but I hope people will, that have the opportunity to make these decisions, think about this and take it to heart.
I think it's going to be a meme. Be Mrs. Davis. What would Mrs. Davis do?
I watched it again. I turned it on. I'm going to show it to my students at Clemson next week. It's always important to be selfless. Sometimes it's more important than other times.
Well, it's one of my faves, Manus, so you wouldn't have to talk me into watching it again. I love that movie. I want to come back to the interest rate hike because I think we've done a number of analysis, and we had Matt Anderson on our pod last week who illuminated a variety of points on this. And I got to tell you, he has been so busy this week with inquiries that we've had from media, clients, other people in the market. He's burning the midnight oil in California, but he looked at a couple of pieces for us to give us some deep dive into what's going on.
Yeah, so Matt actually put out a report that if you haven't been able to download or haven't seen it, we placed it on LinkedIn and Twitter, but if you'd like for us to send you a copy of his report, we're happy to send that to you. Just send an email request to podcast@trepp.com. But he actually looks at, you know, the impacts of 25 basis point increase to the Fed's fund rate and what would happen to bank securities holdings and how it would reduce securities values by approximately $8 billion. So as it stood before the Fed made a decision yesterday, he was showing there's about $52 billion worth of capital that needed to be raised across multiple banks. And a 25 basis point increase was going to only exacerbate that by another $8 billion to the negative. And he actually, in the report, I think looks at about 100 basis point strata. So you actually get a pretty good feel for how, you know, 25, 50 basis points, while they maybe don't sound like that much, across the system have significant impact. And so it's a really great piece. You know, Matt, as you mentioned, Martha, he's been on multiple calls this week. He's been quoted in multiple publications this week. I hope he's, you know, taking some honey at night or doing something to keep that that voice in good tone, because I don't think we're going to see anything lightening up on his workload over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, he sounded more and more like 70-year-old Bob Dylan a couple hours ago when I spoke to him. But for those that don't know Matt and or didn't listen to our podcast last week, let me first say that last week's podcast was terrific from the perspective of what we got out of Matt in terms of insights. But he's been doing this for us for 11 or 12 years now. During the last crisis, he accurately predicted, I think, 298 out of the 303 or 305 banks that were seized. I think the ones that he missed were functions of fraud. So he almost batted 1,000 in terms of his expectation of what was going to fail and what did fail. And he's really a incredibly knowledgeable guy on things like tier one capital, stress tests, CCAR, anything that has to do with forward-looking projections of income, losses, and so forth on bank balance sheets and income statements. And it's not just for the SIFI banks. He does this for all 4,000 or 5,000 or 6,000 US banks that are out there. So not just a great guy, but a guy who puts out great research.
Yeah, man, it's really incredible when you look at how Matt's, you know, projections in the last downturn, how accurate those were. A lot of people may not know some tools that the market could rely on and utilize in a similar fashion the way Matt has to see what's happening in real time. So if you're interested in that, you should definitely reach out, because we have an entire product suite on the banking side that measures a lot of the things that we're going through right now. And we'd be happy to walk through what those options could be for you if you're of interest in the current turmoil.
So one of the things that has been part of a debate this week is the FDIC insurance for depositors above $250,000. That's something that's going to be probably debated and will be interesting to see whether Congress can make any decision on that in the short term. But Lonnie, you've thought about this a little bit. And I think last week, one of the things we talked about after the pod was over was the FHA deposit insurance.
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting. You know, we're talking a lot about FDIC and uninsured deposits and so forth with the limit of $250,000 currently. And after the pod last week, as we were talking, you know, Manus made a point that when banks are taken over, generally, you know, they recoup about 85% of whatever through proceeds on sale and et cetera. So it got me thinking, like in residential real estate, you know, if you take out a mortgage loan and you put less than 20% down on a conventional mortgage, the lender will require that you purchase private mortgage insurance, which effectively, you know, insures the lender against loss on that top 20%. So if you put 5% down, they're effectively getting an insurance policy for the remaining 15%. The FHA has a very similar program. It's actually even more lenient for borrowers in the sense that on residential, they can purchase a home for 3.5% down and then get insurance. It's a little bit different. Instead of private mortgage insurance, it's called mortgage insurance premium or MIP. But effectively, the borrower is required to purchase an MIP policy that covers the lender, again, for that, you know, 20% threshold. So in this instance, as Manus and I were talking, I thought maybe it would make sense that if the FDIC wants to keep the $250,000 limit in place on deposits, that there could be some other type of private or government-sponsored insurance program that insures some percentage should a bank be taken over and assets be liquidated to make whole. So that way you don't have to have a blanket insurance, you know, for all deposits. You're effectively just insuring the ones that are taken over and are sold out. But it does provide some faith in the system for the depositor so that they're not doing the bank runs and other things. So, you know, I don't know at scale what that looks like, but it has proven to be really effective on the residential side. And maybe something like that could be viable in this type of scenario.
So let me ask you this, Lonnie, I just want to scratch beneath the surface there a little bit. So who's paying the insurance there? Is it the bank or the person who has the account, right? Is this something that it's passed through as a bank fee, or do you see, you know, a guy has, you know, like Roku did $300 million at Silicon Valley Bank. They're the one paying a charge. How do you see it working?
Yeah, I think you could have two options. So in the residential space, the borrower obviously is the one paying for the policy. So if you took that same model and extrapolated over here, you would see the depositor would be the one paying for the insurance. But in the example of Roku, if you're going to have hundreds of millions of dollars in the bank and you don't want the headache of having to spread that across multiple institutions, you might be willing to pay for that policy for convenience. Basically, it becomes a convenience fee at that point and gives you certainty that your deposits are safe. For the, you know, non-$100 million type of clients, it would be a nominal enough fee that the banks could probably pass it on. Maybe in this, you know, immediate instance, the government or somebody would offset some of those with credits or something like that to solidify the system. But I think that would all have to be decided. But if you look at the last 20 years and the number of bank failures, and if everyone paid a small percentage, you would build up some coffers pretty quick to cover these types of downturns. So it's not like you're having claims on this daily, monthly, yearly. This is kind of seems to be once every 10 plus year type of cycle.
Yeah, there was a piece today on Zero Hedge, and maybe you could look at it during the next week, Lonnie, and comment on it next week. I think they were citing B of A research, but they did a projection on what the FDIC would have to charge for the entire banking system to be insured. And I think what they said was you couldn't possibly finance it today, because if you're doing it through the banks, it would have to be over time. And I think it was like a 50 basis point reduction in their ROE if you made the banks endure this by themselves. I think what they said they'd have to target is a fund of $100 to $200 billion to mimic what they have now in place for $250,000 deposits, something like that. So maybe we'll go back and revisit that. But I do think that if they do roll out something like this, I think it would be incredibly important to do this with a lot more attention to detail than what we did during COVID, right? I think there's a big difference between insuring a guy who has $1 million and you're giving him another $750,000 versus that $300 million guy that has the ability to do it, but you're giving him a convenience level, right? And I do think that, or an individual, a private individual, like I think a lot of these Silicon Valley bank depositors were wealthy individuals in California. So the devil will be in the details, but I think you're really onto something. I think it's a great idea. And, you know, I know Janet Yellen and Jay Powell listen every week. So if you do take this, I do hope that you give Lonnie his appropriate credit where due. The Lonnie rule.
And as we saw this week, some very big layoffs, Accenture, Amazon, Indeed, and some others mentioned that are possibly indicators of what's to come.
Yeah, and that doesn't even touch upon Credit Suisse, who could be 10,000 or 20,000 employees worldwide once that merger goes through, or Signature Bank or Silicon Valley Bank, or I think that even if these other banks that are down 40, 50, 60, 70% in their share price, you have to believe that they are looking right now to aggressively cut costs. So when you look at all this, not a great week for the numbers there. You know, when this starts showing up in any kind of size remains to be seen. The first time jobless claims today were incredibly low. It just continues to defy logic. It's funny. Powell, the rate hike, kind of a footnote for the week. The layoffs, kind of a footnote, and everything is about banks, risk premiums, and Janet Yellen right now.
Yeah, just to give some context to the Accenture job cuts, they said about 19,000 worldwide. And one of the interesting numbers there was they said it would spend about $1.2 billion in severance. They're going to do another consolidation of office space to the tune of about $300 million. So they're, you know, to your point, man, it's really trying to cut costs. Another interesting tidbit was the Walmart announcement. So they're laying off hundreds of workers at 5 e-commerce fulfillment centers. So maybe bad news on the macro there that they're reducing their footprint at some of these fulfillment centers. Although they were quick to say it doesn't impact what they're calling their current modernization efforts. So, you know, they're still trying to put a nice spin on it. Hundreds of jobs for Walmart. Indeed was another one, 2,200 jobs. So I wonder on that one, are they giving their former employees like preferential profile treatment when they look for new jobs on the Indeed app?
Indeed.
And all of that leads us into the sector that everybody is talking about, which is the office sector. A lot of troubling stories there.
Yes, very little green shoot activity, lots of crabgrass. I'll run through these as quickly as I can. The first one, this is from Rich Bachman of The Real Deal. One Liberty in Manhattan, which was a $1.5 billion valuation in 2017, a 50% share of that was sold for $500 million this week. So a drop in value from $1.5 billion to $1 billion over the last 6 years. Not a good sign. Crabgrass, Lauren Anesorge, the Triangle Business Journal. Citrix Systems is planning to sublease 150,000 square feet in Raleigh. At the same time today, a few minutes ago, Fidelity announced that they were vacating 120,000 square feet in Durham. Other stories here, we talked about 11 Madison Avenue. There, Credit Suisse is the dominant tenant, certainly an asset to watch. It is a 2.3 million square foot office in Manhattan. If Credit Suisse is to vacate, that would leave a huge hole there. In Minneapolis, United Health giving even more space up. Their headquarters at 9900 Bren Road East, which backs a $50 million single tenant CMBS loan, is now being offered for sale or sublease. In the past, United Health had already put 475,000 square feet out for sublease by its subsidiary Optum and 150,000 square feet of its own space out on Whitewater Drive. All of these stories, by the way, by Kelly Bush of the Minneapolis Business Journal. Now, United Health is adding another 150,000 square feet to that number. In Silicon Valley, Intel and Analog Devices are both seeking buyers for their offices. It doesn't appear like these will be long-term sale leaseback. They may be short-term leaseback situations, but in essence, Intel and Analog Devices both looking to give up sizable pieces of square footage. In Intel's case, 500,000 square feet. For Analog Devices, 300,000 square feet. In San Francisco, Laura Waxman, San Francisco Business Times, Reddit relocating and downsizing by about 40% from 78K to 47K. In the Washington Business Journal, The Motley Fool is going to give up its space. This is Washington, D.C., by the way, giving up 120,000 square feet in Alexandria in Virginia. In New York, first time watch list comments for a $265 million office loan indicated the top tenant, which is a for-profit college, ASA College, has vacated. They have 65% of the space at Herald Center near Macy's in Midtown. And that's all I have for now. I could have gone on and on and on. That is a short, believe it or not, abridged version of what could have been 20 or 25 crabgrass stories that we could have gone through today.
So a couple of comments on those stories real quick, man. It's on the Brookfield story. Could you imagine waking up and taking a $500 million hit on a value just like that? I mean, that's really crazy. And the fact that those numbers just get tossed around and those transactions get done with that type of a haircut is just, it's astounding. But we're going to see more of those is my prediction. I think on the Raleigh story and the Durham story, it's really interesting. The Carolinas had caught fire coming out of COVID, and they were kind of seen as the next hot market. And I think over the last month or so, we've had several negative stories about people downsizing and other things there. So that's one of those markets where you maybe wonder if the infrastructure and the underlying fundamentals there just having a hard time supporting the rapid growth and if they're not able to sustain longer term. So I think I'd be keeping an eye on those markets. And then the Minneapolis stuff, I mean, it's really, we've talked more about Minneapolis in the last 6 months than I've probably talked about Minneapolis in 20 years. And so in CRE, if you look at all the sublease space, a lot of corporate headquarters up there, a lot of them trying to sell campuses, really, really tough time for that market now. Not great news for the office market. So we have a couple of reports that we're going to make available for our listeners. And so I'll walk through those quickly, both action-packed with a lot of data, you know, primarily tied to the office sector. So as Manish just ran through the stories, a lot of negative news around the office markets. One of the reports is based off of our Taller data set. So you've heard us reference that on the pod before, but effectively it's an anonymized loan level repository sourced from data provided by large and mid-sized banks, shows collateral attributes and loan performance over time. What we've done is standardized risk rating for those office loans in the Taller data set and put a report together that highlights certain markets that signify, you know, potential risk based on those risk ratings. So, you know, interestingly enough, Minneapolis is on the report. This is from fourth quarter 22 data. It's actually on the lower end of the spectrum. The average risk rating for office loans in that market is just over 3. But if you look at San Francisco, they're approaching 6. And in our risk rating profile, anything above 6 is considered a criticized loan. The risk rating scale is from 1 to 9, with 1 being least risky and 9 being most risky. And anything above 6 is considered criticized. So San Francisco is leading the pack on a relative basis for the risk percentage or risk rating. We had one other report that we're going to make available. This is from our own Emily Yu. She did an analysis on the biggest changes in delinquency by MSA. So if you remember back to our February delinquency numbers, the office sector saw, I think, about a 30 or 40 basis point increase in the delinquency percentage. And so we've actually gone in by MSA and shown which MSAs have had the biggest delta. And so this will give you a really good idea. Top states, top five states with delinquency. Pennsylvania ranked number one with the largest increase. And then Missouri also saw a large increase in the retail delinquency. So really great reports. We can't cover all the details on the pod. We wish we could, but we hope these reports act as a really nice supplement to some of the data that we just have to talk topically about.
I never like leaving the office segment without at least one green shoot. So I will throw out a green shoot. I'll preface this by saying this particular story made me think of the people that go surfing during hurricanes. You know, either you think that they're crazy or you have like incredible admiration for their courage. In this case, I'm going to go with the incredible admiration for their courage. The story comes from a publication called New York YIMBY, which I think stands for Yes in My Backyard. Excavation begins for Rolex headquarters tower at 665 Fifth in Midtown Manhattan. That's the headline of the article. The property will be a 28-story building, which is at, I think, about 55th or 56th and Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. It will be a 420-foot tall structure with 200,000 square feet of space. And I don't know, Lonnie, what do you think? Is this crazy or is this admirable?
I'm probably leaning more on the crazy side. And so, you know, I don't know if it's YOLO territory, but it's definitely on the crazier end of the spectrum, in my opinion. However, they are going to have a little bit of a retail component to that. So maybe they're going to sell some of the Rolex watches, which if you've been tracking that on the secondary market, Rolex has outperformed the S&P and several other investments over the last few years. So maybe it makes it, I don't know.
Martha, you were probably a surfer back in the day, weren't you?
I'm more of a boogie board kind of person.
Gotcha.
Safer. All right. One topic tied to some of the regulatory stuff that we were talking about earlier was the Real Estate Roundtable, which if people know in the industry, they do lobbying on behalf of real estate, especially commercial real estate. And they had an open letter calling for some emergency measures that would help the industry by having borrowers and lenders have ways to work out short-term debt extensions.
Yeah, I'm going to have to take the negative side of this discussion, I think, in the sense that it feels a little bit like a reach to me. I understand the implications of a lot of these maturities and all of the macro market stuff that we've talked about today and the challenges both owner operators and lenders are going to face in the market should there be no intervention. But it's tough for me to look at some of these really large institutional players coming to the market now and saying, oh my goodness, rates have risen so quickly, it's unfair and we can't refinance our property and we need to have somebody help us extend the debt, you know, and give us some time. On the upside, when the market was going crazy and we were in a zero interest rate environment, they weren't feeling bad about increasing rental rates and taking those 1031 proceeds and buying other buildings and doing all the stuff that was happening on the uptick. And so it's very interesting how quickly the market shifts and that attitude changes as well. So these are the same people that were bemoaning eviction moratorium and student loan forgiveness and all these other things. But, you know, on the flip side, if you look at COVID, the airlines got, you know, definitely helped out with federal stimulus and other things to keep them afloat. Hotels received, you know, some help. So there's a precedent in today's environment. I just think as a real estate investor, part of the investment cycle is that you have a decline in the ecosystem. You have growth, equilibrium, decline, revitalization. And if the government continues to prevent the decline component of that, it just makes it really interesting to see if we're actually talking about real market derived values and investments, or if these are just some semblance of that with a backstop so people take riskier bets and continue to push the envelope.
Yeah, I'm more on the fence than you, Lonnie. I think that it all comes down to, is what we're facing right now a generational crisis like we saw in 2008? Or isn't it? Is this a normal cycle or is it something much worse? Now, if this turns out to be not as bad as maybe I suggested it could be during the open, then they should get the same treatment that the mall owners got, which is no relief at all, right? This is a down cycle. My gut is that this crimping of liquidity, this availability of cash, will be extremely dramatic. And while I'm not in favor of intervention that allows for bailouts, and I do think it should be targeted, the notion that a bank could not put something into a criticized bucket and be forced to sell in a time where there's no buyers sounds reasonable. To make modifications to REMIC laws that give the special servicers more latitude, I'm okay with. I think that worked out extraordinarily well for hotels and retail during the COVID period. And I would be okay with that if the unintended consequences were well understood and thought through. You know, the thing that really got me to take that side of the argument is the notion that we've started this program where banks can pledge underwater assets to the Fed and get collateral back, right? So there is not forced selling of securities right now. However, when you look at a place like First Republic, I think the number is 80% of what they have is illiquid, is not pledgeable. And if they get into a situation, and we saw this week, by the way, that there were no takers for the Signature rent-controlled multifamily portfolio, or at least New York Community Bank wasn't a taker. So this idea that you can avoid a negative feedback loop where there is forced selling, selling at big discounts begets lower valuations, which begets more selling, which begets more lower valuations. If we can avoid that, I'm for it. And, but then again, it shouldn't be used as a vehicle like PPP was, where you're just extending your loan for the benefit of keeping a 4% handle in because you don't feel like paying 7%. How you sweat the details, I don't know, but hopefully people do the honorable thing and, you know, don't game the system. I mean, I think there's a lot of that in our society now. I hope people take the high road.
Yeah, I think if you could get a program that accounted for some of those challenges, like with PPP and some of these other things where you're looking back, you're like, oh my goodness, people really abused the system. You know, I'm in agreement with you that maybe for the betterment of the overall market, there's some middle ground there. And so it'll be interesting. One thing that I think, you know, I kind of smile or chuckle at a little bit, and we've heard for the last 2 years about all this dry powder on the sidelines, right? And everyone's just waiting to pounce on these opportunities when the distress comes. Nobody's talking about the dry powder right now. You know, nobody coming in and buying these assets at scale and deploying that capital. So I don't know if it went away, if it ever existed, or if they're just kind of going quiet, waiting for the opportunities, and they're actually going to take action now.
Well, I think there's three things going on. We talked about in the open that these non-bank lenders, they rely on liquidity from banks. And to the extent that their positions are being squeezed with lower LTV demands or additional collateral being put up, that's part of it for sure. I think people don't believe we've seen distressed selling yet. So nobody wants to be the first mover. They're waiting for that 20%, 25%, 30% haircut that they think is coming. And I think that, you know, these forced redemptions at both banks, which are having depositor runs, and the REITs, right, Brookfield and Starwood, is making people really squirrel away that liquidity. Whatever dry powder they have, they're grateful for.
I think that's fair. It's just interesting. 6 weeks ago, you could have found 50 articles per week talking about the dry powder that's ready to scoop these assets up. And that's kind of like we talked about last week. Like, distress as a concept is great. Distress in real life sucks. And I think people are realizing that now, that when it's actual distress and we're not just talking about distress, you got to have a lot of conviction to know that you're doing what you think you can execute on, because a lot of these guys, they're just showing right now. I mean, they don't have the fortitude to do it. And if you look at the roundtable, I mean, there's a lot of institutional representatives on the roundtable. I think they have all the big major players, Starwood, Blackstone, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't think that discussion's going away. And to your point, Manus, hopefully we can get the right people in the right rooms and come up with some sort of a solution that that does make it better for everybody and doesn't just benefit a few selected winners.
There's so much more we could cover on this podcast. In fact, one of our listeners I spoke to this week said we could do a podcast right now every day. There's so much stuff out there. We're not going to get to everything we want to, but some of the things I'd like to revisit next week are, you know, this REIT stuff. I know you had thoughts on it last week that we didn't get to, how that was the canary in the coal mine of liquidity 2 months ago. I think that a Wall Street Journal article today about the Signature rent-controlled assets being toxic waste, that deserves more attention. And this person I was speaking to today also, she's a believer that we are now looking at a similar cycle to 2008 in terms of length, that we are looking at a 2 to 3 year cycle where banks are either accepting assets or special servicers are extending and pretending without any rush to sell them because prices will continue spiraling lower before they bottom out, right? There's not a big bid there. And maybe those will be some of the things we cover next week.
So as you mentioned, Mass, we could probably go on and talk a lot more, but we've probably ignored retail, hotel, and multifamily property sectors the last couple of weeks. We've got a lot of stories there that we could cover on valuation, special servicing, and other changes. So we will probably cover that next week, closer to the end of the month. And hopefully we haven't missed anything major. Our programming note is our Market Pulse webinar, which is tomorrow at 1 o'clock. We've got Matt Anderson, Stephen Buschbaum, and Lonnie Henry, and they're going to be talking about the banks and why what's happening with them matters, as everyone probably is interested. So we've had a really good bunch of people sign up for that. If you're interested, let us know. We'll give you the information of how to register. Shout outs. And first, I have to say, we've had a lot of people reach out to us in this last week. If we haven't gotten back to you, it's just because we have a lot of inquiries that are incoming. So we will get to you, I promise. But some of the people we've gotten shout outs, John B. sent us a long email on some questions that he had. Nick N. loves how the podcast tackles tough issues and had a question about positive leverage, which honestly, I have Matt Anderson doing the math on. So we'll see how that turns out. Isaac R. recommended us on LinkedIn. Jason J. loved Matt's analysis of the bank fallout. Deborah M. sent a message for Lonnie. Everything is fine until it isn't, which I think was your quote, Lonnie. Alec P. he says he's listened to the episode a couple times. Although the dog is extra tired, if you're in the CRE industry, episode 187 is a must listen. Ben P. loved our pod on the banks and wanted a deeper dive into non-bank lenders. So we'll have to cover that at some point. John L., Steve K., Gary R., Shlomo C. loves to hear his name from us. So I thought I'd give him another one there. Harrison K., Robert V., Chris S., and a number of other people. Like I said, if we haven't gotten to you, we will. And you know, guys, I just want to say, crazy as it is, it's our 3-year anniversary. So I can't even tell you, this has been the craziest 3 years I've ever had between the COVID and then the post-COVID and then the post-post-COVID. It seems like every year there's a new unprecedented series of news events that we're covering.
Well, let me first say that I am so grateful to have the three of you guys to put up with me every week. I'm shocked that you do so. I mean, I would be so sick of my own voice. I am right now. but I'm also grateful for our audience. As Haley pointed out to us this week, we're up to almost 7,000 listeners a week, which is just extraordinary that there are so many people out there that follow us. I'm just amazed by the thoughtfulness of the questions, just what people come up to us to have us think about, respond to, the maturity of the audience. You know, you see other people communicate on Twitter and how toxic it can be. You know, in 3 years, I've yet to have a situation where our back and forth with somebody has been anything more than professional, debating, you know, our points professionally and without any attitude. It's so life-affirming when you see that compared to what you see on television and other places on Twitter. So I'm just really grateful for that. And I look forward to another 3 weeks of this.
I think it was years. I think it was years.
I did say that as a joke.
Yeah, sure you did.
Yeah, I would just echo the sentiment. I mean, I haven't been here for the full 3 years on the pod as a regular, but having been on for the last year plus, it's been really exhilarating. And to both of your points, I mean, I think the interaction with our listeners has just grown significantly, and it makes what we call the funnest or best part of our week even more rewarding when we hear people or see people sharing our podcast or interacting with us. And it just means that what we're trying to provide here is resonating with the masses, and we love doing it. It's a privilege, and we're excited to continue to do it. And I think while we'd love to have nothing but great news all the time, the market and the world doesn't work that way. And I think it's a great place for us to be able to come together and talk about what's happening in real time based on data, not just opinion, and try to inform, you know, the folks that listen to us. So we're going to continue to put our best foot forward and try to continue to educate and learn from the people listening to us. So thank you if you are listening, and we appreciate your dedication and the feedback that you share with us.
And to Lonnie's point, you know, we do try to call them like we see them. And when it's dark and negative, we don't try to hold back, but these dark days don't last forever. And it is a wonderful life. And do the right thing out there and help your fellow man. And there'll be bankers out of work and CRE lenders out of work. And the more we look out for each other, the faster we'll come out of this.
And where would we be without Haley Keene, our producer? So thank you, Haley, for your dedication, late night editing, and all the other stuff that you do that only we know about behind the scenes. So with that, we'll close. Join us next week as we look at what's happened during the week and how it may be impacting you. If you have a question or a comment, send your email to podcast@trepp.com and subscribe to the podcast with your favorite provider. Thank you for listening, and stay well.
All right.